I'm a little surprised that you're here. After telling you yesterday I don't have any clue what I'm doing, I thought that would pretty much undercut the week. So I want to preface anything we talk about today just by pointing out the obvious. Take this with a grain of salt. This is a journey that God has had me on, especially when it comes to making disciples in the local church as a pastor. Pastoring was not on the radar for me 3 years ago at this time. And God in His grace began to lead me in a different direction. The reason I am pastoring. If there are a billion plus people in the world who have little to no knowledge of the name of Jesus or the gospel of Christ, then my wife and I have said the only way we can live here instead of living over there is if we're convinced we're doing more here to affect what's going on over there than we would if we were living there. And whenever that's not the case, we want to take a one-way ticket and be over there. I want to pastor. The reason I'm pastoring, I want to lead a church, as I shared a little bit yesterday, that impacts nations for the glory of Christ. And what you've got here in front of you is the picture of how the command in Matthew 28:19, I see played out in the local church. And what I want to do is I basically want to share the picture of how disciple-making is looking at Brook Hills right now, the church that God's entrusted me to lead. And along the way, you'll see truths that I believe are foundational for what disciple-making looks like in the local church. I would certainly not presume to say that this is how it must look or even should look, but this is my effort by the grace of Christ to lead this church to make disciples. So I'm going to fly through this. What I want to do is there's a couple of sections where I'm going to camp out a little bit in these notes, but I wanted to give you as much information as possible for you to have some takeaway. But I want to fly through a lot of this. So we're going to be going pretty quickly at points so that we can free up time for a question and answer at the end of our time. So what you've got at the top there is the picture of the Church of Brook Hills. If you or to look at our church, one statement that sums up the church that God's entrusted me to lead: we glorify Christ by making disciples of all nations. And in that one statement, you see our vision, our mission, and our goal. Our vision is to glorify Christ, our mission is to make disciples, and our goal is to impact nations for the glory of Christ. Vision, mission, and goal. Practically how that plays out, what we've said is if we're going to do anything well, we're going to do these three things well in the church. We're going to do worship gatherings that glorify Christ well. We're going to do small groups that are doing disciple-making, and we're going to do short-term missions that is impacting the world. We want to do those three things well, and we believe that if we're doing these three things well, and if people in our faith family are worshiping in a way that glorifies Christ, in small groups that are doing disciple-making, and connecting with what God's doing around the world through short-term missions, that the result will be them impacting the world by making disciples, world-impacting disciple-makers. So what I want to do is I want to unpack each of those. That just gives you a little frame of reference for the things I'm going to talk about. We glorify Christ. This is the vision of the church. Following Christ, becoming like Him is the vision, and this is where I would say this is normative. I think it's the vision of every Christian and every church. This is pre-written and not up for us to negotiate. Here's what I mean by that. Vision is who we are, what we're becoming. And the goal of every Christian and the goal of every church is to know and become like Christ. This is Philippians 3:10. I want to know Christ. Philippians 1:21, to live as Christ. He is my life. He is my everything. This is Matthew 4:18. It all starts with, follow me. Fix your eyes on me, your heart on me. When you ask a pastor to describe his vision, if we say things like, well, my vision is to have this many hundred or this many thousand people in the church. If my vision is to have this many buildings or this or that. When we say things like that, we show that somewhere along the way we have lost our pursuit of Christ and the pursuit of stuff in the church. Christ is our vision. He is who we are becoming like. We want Him. And this is the picture. This is the picture right here, follow me, and the notes beneath it are a sermon I preached on Matthew 4:18-22. And I'm going to fly through these things. But when you think about what it means in a biblical understanding of discipleship, what it means to be a disciple of Christ, it means radical abandonment for the glory of Christ. We leave behind all things. We leave behind our comfort and our careers, our possessions and our positions, our families and our friends, our safety and ourselves. And we live for one thing. We want to honor the King. We want the King more than anything else. More than we want our moms or our dads or our wives or our children. More than we want comfort or safety. We want Christ. And everything is trumped by the supremacy of Christ in our life when we are followers of His. Second, it's radical dependence on the grace of Christ. Dependence on the grace of Christ. Put those two together, you've got the picture of costly grace and the cost of discipleship. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, it is costly because it costs us everything. It's grace because we're following Christ. He takes the initiative to choose us. We didn't sign up for this thing. He signed us up. He has called us to Himself. He provides the power to use us, and He gets the glory through us. Third, radical adherence to the person of Christ. This is huge right here. What it means to follow Christ. Follow me. This is a personal call to these disciples in Matthew 4, 18. The essence of Jesus' method. There was no formal school that He had set up. There were no seminaries that He led. No membership classes that He organized. No highly organized procedures or formulas at all. Jesus was His own school and curriculum. His life was His own school and curriculum. The implications of that, and we're going to unpack this in just a minute, are huge. The implications of Jesus' method tell us that we are free from legalistic ritualism, and we are free to focus on building people, not programs. As leaders in the church, if this is the way Jesus calls us to Himself, then that means we're free to focus on building people, not programs. This is, I think, one of the greatest challenges that I and the staff that I lead are facing. Trying to reorient our thinking. The purpose of staff is not to plan events or to provide services. That the purpose of church leaders are to equip people, to build people, to love Christ and proclaim the glory of Christ to the nations. We're building people to that end, not just planning events or providing services for them and their families. That misses the point. So, radical adherence to the person of Christ. Fourth, radical trust in the authority of Christ. We're going to talk about this some more tomorrow. But we must be gripped by the reality that Christ is worthy of our worship. This is where the Great Commission starts. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. That means you and I in this room, as followers of Christ, we have sacrificed the right to determine the direction of our lives. We don't call the shots anymore. It's not our ambitions. It's not our future. It's His life, His future, His ambitions in us. He determines everything, and we're second in command. He's worthy of our worship. Not only our worship, though, He is worthy of their worship. And this is why we give ourselves to making disciples of all nations. Because there's 300 million people in this country, and the overwhelming majority of them today are headed to a Christless eternity. And Jesus Christ is worthy of every single one of their worship. This is why we go to Africa, because there's 3,000 tribes in Africa that are following animistic religions that are completely devoid of God. And Jesus Christ is worthy of every single one of their worship. It's why we go to Japan and Laos and Vietnam, because there's 350 million Buddhists in those countries who are following Buddha's rules and Buddha's regulations. And He's not worthy. Jesus is worthy of all of their worship. This is why we go to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Maldives, because there's 950 million Hindus in those countries that are following more gods than you or I can even fathom. And there's only one God who is worthy of all of their glory. It's why we go to communist nations like China, North Korea, Laos, because there's over 1 billion people in those countries that have grown up with atheistic philosophies that completely deny the existence of God. That many of them don't even have a word for God. And there is a God, and He's worthy of all their worship. And it's why we go to the tough places. It's why we go to the Middle East. Because there's 1.3 billion Muslims in this world today who are fasting and giving alms and making holy pilgrimages to Mecca and praying 5 times a day to a false God. And Jesus Christ is worthy of every single one of their worship. That drives us. I've got to be careful. I can't just preach 10 sermons today. Okay. Radical trust in the authority of Christ. This drives the Great Commission. Finally, radical obedience to the mission of Christ. Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. So, the mission of Christ. We glorify Christ. You see, that's foundational. That's our vision. Making disciples. It's our mission. The command is clear in Matthew 28, 19. You got going, baptizing, teaching, these verbs, these participles surrounding. But what you've got at the core is one command, make disciples. One command in the Great Commission. I believe, next page there, I believe the command has been compromised. It's been compromised. And here's what I mean by that. I think we are tempted to do everything except the one thing Jesus told us to do in the Great Commission. I want you to follow with me here. Jesus never told us to build colleges, universities, or seminaries. He never told us to erect hospitals, shelters, and homes for the aged. He never told us to construct church buildings. He never told us to organize Sunday school. He never told us to organize a convention. He never told us to organize an international mission board or a North American mission board. He didn't tell us to do any of these things. But he did tell us to make disciples in every part of the world. Now, that doesn't mean those things are bad. But here's the danger. Do we realize that it's possible, for example, for you in this room to go to seminary and be a pastor for 40 years? I believe it's possible to go to seminary and be a pastor for 40 years and never make disciples. I believe it's possible to go to seminary and go overseas with the International Mission Board and never make disciples. We are tempted to do everything except the one thing Jesus told us to do, commanded us to do in the Great Commission. And all of these things only have meaning in so much as they fuel the command of Christ in our lives and in the church. If these things are not fueling that command, then we've missed the point from the beginning. The last thing I would do today is call you to go overseas with the International Mission Board, or go somewhere with the North American Mission Board, or do this or that in this church. I would call you to make disciples, period. And the reality is that command is not dependent on some position that we might have. We don't have to wait to do that. We don't have to figure out how that looks in different places. We've got an opportunity now, and you live in Louisville, I live in Birmingham. We make disciples, period. This is what we give ourselves to. It's the command of Christ. Here's the all-important question, though, when we think about our plans, personally and our plans in the church. Are our plans self-directed or Christ-directed? This is a huge question. Are our plans self-directed or Christ-directed? We have a tendency to create our own plans out of self-directed Christianity. And we even follow through with those plans with the motive to glorify God. Here's what I mean by that. Think most of us would say in the churches we lead, we're doing all kinds of stuff. And at the core, there's probably good motives behind what we're doing. But the reality is, God does not bless based solely on our motives. I don't want to say the motives aren't important. Living for the glory of God is obviously very important. But God does not bless based solely on our motives. The reality is God always blesses His plan. Always. We give ourselves to plans that we dream up with a God-glorifying motive. We're not assured the blessing of God. We give ourselves to making disciples. We're assured the blessing of God. If we're wise in church leadership, that means we're going to give ourselves fully to what we know is assured the blessing of God. He has promised to bless His plan. So what does that plan look like? Look at the life of Christ. I want you to see this, the command in Christ. John chapter 17, I think, is a huge chapter for understanding Jesus' relationship with His disciples. The very beginning of that chapter, remember, this is when He prays for His disciples and eventually for us at the end of the chapter. And He says at the very beginning, He says, I have finished or completed the work that You have given Me to do, saying this to the Father. And what's interesting is in John 17, Jesus never mentions the miracles He performed or the multitudes to whom He preached. But over 40 times He mentions the men whom God had given Him out of the world. He never mentions the masses or the miracles or the multitudes to whom He'd preached. 40 times He talks about these 12 men that God had given Him, the Father had given Him out of the world. His strategy was to revolutionize the hearts of a few and they would impact the world. And this is the crux. Question is, the men or the masses? You listen to the way we talk about growing churches and the way we throw around numbers or statistics. Look at all the people. And then compare that, the way we talk about church growth numbers or statistics, with Jesus. Whenever the crowds got big, what would Jesus do? Start talking about eating His flesh and drinking His blood. Can you just imagine the looks on His disciples' faces at that point? Jesus, we will never get on the list of fastest growing movements if You keep telling people to eat You. Imagine how frustrating. What was He doing? Why was He turning away the crowds? Start getting big. Well, you got to hate your father and your mother to follow Me. Oh, okay. See ya. That's what would happen. Why was He doing this? Because, this is the picture, Jesus was spending more time with His disciples than everybody else in the world put together. Did that mean He didn't care about the masses? No. Jesus devoted himself to a few men rather than the masses so that the masses might be saved. This is the whole picture. Acts chapter 1, verse 15. You got 120 people who've actually stuck around in Jerusalem and done what Jesus told them to do. You think about that. This is what even secular scholars would obviously call one of the greatest religious teachers in the history of the world. And at the end of his time on this planet, he's got 120 people to show for it. That is no mega church. That is a mini church, really. This is the picture. Was Jesus a failure? Only 120 people to show for yourself? No, this was a genius. Because what would happen is in the days to come, those 120, and particularly those 11, would turn the nations upside down for the glory of Christ. This is the picture of disciple making. And the reality is, disciples cannot be mass produced. They cannot be mass produced. Jesus shows us this. If Jesus didn't do it, then why would we think that we're good enough to do something like that? Mass-produced disciples. This takes time, investment, people. So how does that look in the church? Here's the reality. As pastor, I was talking about disciple-making all the time before the church that I lead. And then it hit me. The people in front of me have no clue what it means to make disciples. If you were to go across the average person sitting in front of me on a Sunday morning, and maybe in the church that you're a part of or that you lead, and you were to ask people, what does it mean to make disciples? Would you get a uniform response? Would you have people who understand what it means to make disciples? If not, I think that's a problem. This is the command that Jesus gave us, and we don't know how to do it, and somewhere along the way we've missed something. So what we did is we went into a study and led them through, and we looked at the Great Commission in Matthew 28 and how that whole picture of discipleship began there in Matthew chapter 4, verse 18 through 22. We looked at John 17, and what we did is we identified four primary components in disciple-making. And this is how I understand disciple-making. Four primary components, and it's where these things intersect together. They seem almost general, but it's where they intersect together. Four components: sharing the word, showing the word, teaching the word, and serving the world. I want to unpack each of those. It's where those come together. This can't happen on large scale. This happens in small scale. Individual relationships, small groups, like we talked about. Small groups, I think, are the primary avenue for disciple making to occur. What do I mean by share the word, show the word, teach the word, and serve the world? Share the word. We equip people to be gospel living and gospel sharing. What I mean by that is I want the people that I lead to see how the gospel is woven into the fabric of their being. Every facet of their lives affected by the gospel. Because when they see that, then they'll see how the details of their lives become a platform for sharing the gospel on a continual basis. Gospel living, gospel sharing. We encourage them to be confident in God's sovereignty, not man's savvy. Try to encourage our people over and over again when it comes to evangelism, sharing the gospel, that God's got this thing rigged. And there are people that he's drawing to himself, and we can go out with great confidence as a result of that. And we can talk to our coworkers with great confidence. Not because we got it all figured out and we got the memorized presentation, but because God's got it all figured out and he's drawing them to himself. And we're living the gospel, sharing the gospel. It's going to happen. People are going to come to know Christ. We teach them to share life, not laws. I want to be careful with that. I don't want to say, I'm not trying to communicate that we need to avoid the propositional content of the gospel. The truths of the gospel. But the reality is, when we share the gospel, when we share Christ, we're not sharing principles as much as we're sharing a person. There are truths that are foundational in that. But we share life. We share Christ. Knowing Christ, becoming like Christ, his life in us. This is what we're sharing with others. So we share the word. We equip our people to lead others to Christ. My desire is that Brook Hills would be a faith family full of people equipped to lead others to Christ. That they would not be dependent on me or a Sunday service or anything else to do that, because they're equipped to do that. I think that's huge, but that's where disciple making starts, not stops. Second, show the word. This is where we take a step deeper, lead somebody to Christ. Then what happens? Put them in a program or Sunday school classroom? No, that's not going to be the most effective thing to do. It's not where... Now, I don't want to hit on programs or Sunday school too hard, but the reality is, think about it with me. New believer, what is the best way for that believer, new believer, to learn how to pray? By putting them in a class on prayer, or by somebody inviting them into their quiet time to say, let me show you how I pray. Let me show you what I've learned about prayer. Let me show you what God's taught me in prayer. Let me show you, let me teach you how to pray. Which is going to be more effective? teach a new believer how to study the Bible. Put them in a class, how to study the Bible 101, or put them next to somebody who knows how to study the Bible. Say, here's how I study the Bible. Here's the questions I ask of the text when I'm reading through a text. Here's how I go systematically through the Bible. I learn the truths. It's how I memorize the Word. That's going to go a lot farther. This is a personal thing. People long to see a demonstration of Christ that accompanies our explanation of Christ. They need to see that. Now, you can't program that. This is relationships. You can't program that. Not saying that we can't use tools or methods or programs to equip people to do this, but the reality is that is extremely personal, and it raises the bar of Christianity, because now every single follower of Christ in the church is intended to be equipped in order to be able to do this in somebody else's life. Now, I want you to see this here. This is where it gets really good. We are devoted to the process of disciple making for others' sanctification. This is where disciple making takes us from a very self-centered faith to a radically God-centered Christianity. We're devoted to the process of disciple making for others' sake. John 17:19. I sanctify myself for who? Jesus says this. I sanctify myself for them, for their sake, that they may be sanctified. This is the picture. Our sanctification. What if our sanctification, our growth in holiness, was not intended just for us? What if our growth in holiness and our sanctification was intended to sanctify others, to lead others to holiness and growth in Christ? What if my relationship with Christ is not just about me becoming holy, but the purpose of my relationship with Christ is to live in such a way that I show the holiness of Christ to the people around me, and they begin to grow in holiness? And I'm now living for them. This is the whole picture of Philippians chapter 4, verse 9. When Paul says, whatever you have learned from me, heard from me, received from me, put it into practice. 1 Corinthians 11:1. Follow me, imitate me as I imitate Christ. That's a bold statement. For the Christian sitting in a pew on a Sunday morning to be able to say to the people around them, you watch how my life looks and you follow me, you imitate me, and you'll be imitating Christ. This is raising the bar. But here's the beauty of it. Look at the second truth there. We're dependent on the process of disciple making for our own sanctification. This is where it comes full circle. If you have the responsibility to teach somebody else how to pray, if a believer has a responsibility to teach somebody else how to pray, then what does that mean that believer needs to be doing? Praying. If they have a responsibility to teach other people how to study the Word, then they've got to be studying the Word. I'm convinced that we will stagnate in our Christian lives until we radically give ourselves to disciple making. There is a level of growth that we will hit, and we will not go beyond it until we start living for the sake of others. And when we live for the sake of others, it will actually increase our own sanctification. This is the beauty. When we're making disciples, we're living for the glory of God and others. 1 Thessalonians, you might write this down. 1 Thessalonians 2:19-20. What does Paul say there? He says, what is our hope, our glory, our crown, our joy, when we will stand in the presence of the Lord Jesus? What is his answer? You. He says, you're our crown and you're our joy. Our crown, our joy in Christianity is seeing the glory of God displayed in those that we are laying down our lives to build the image of Christ in. I live for this. I live through you. Philippians 4:1 says the same thing. You are my joy. This is a radically God-centered, others-focused Christianity. Share the Word, we show the Word. Teach the Word. Here's the question I would ask us as leaders in the church. Are we training receivers or reproducers? Here's what I mean by that. Picture Sudan with me in the middle of a mud hut. Sitting there with Sudanese believers, and you're teaching them the Word. And the whole time you teach them, you hardly ever see their eyes. And it's not because they're sleeping. It's not because they're kind of daydreaming. It's because they are writing down every single thing that you say. And they come up to you afterwards and they say, David, we know that we have a responsibility to take everything you have taught us, translate it into our tribes' languages, and teach it into our tribes. These guys are apparently not listening to receive. They're listening to reproduce. Now bring the picture into an average church building on a Sunday morning. Are we training up receivers or reproducers? Even people who want to, you got your dozers, you got your sleepers, but even people who want to hear a word from God most often want to hear it for their sakes. What happens when the people that we teach the Word of God to begin to listen to the Word of God, not for their sakes, but for others' sakes as well? They're thinking, how can I take this word and reproduce it? We do a reteaching guide at Brook Hills where we equip our people. We want to equip our people. Whatever they hear, when they hear the word taught, they've got to be thinking about where the word's going to go. So we're going to stop with you as they're going to spread through you, Christian. If it stops with you, then Christianity revolves around you and you've missed the purpose. If it's going to spread through you, then Christianity is about making the glory of Christ and the word of Christ known in all nations through disciple making, teaching it to people around you. We have a deal called Secret Church where periodically we gather together and we pray intensively for the persecuted church, and we spend about 6 hours, 6 to midnight, usually goes closer to 7 hours, so close to 1 in the morning. We do an intensive study in the Word. And I say to our folks every single time we do this, say, the purpose of, we did it on the doctrine of God. And so it's basically 6 to 1 in the morning, praying for the persecuted church and learning the doctrine of God. And say at the beginning, the purpose is not for you to learn the doctrine of God tonight. The purpose is for you to walk out of this room tonight equipped to teach other people about the doctrine of God. This gives meaning to what we are doing in this room, beyond this room. If it's all about what's going on in this room, we miss the whole point. We teach the Word. We must train every follower of Christ to know the essentials of following Christ. What does it mean to follow Christ? And then to model, teach, and reproduce the essentials of following Christ. Think about it. If every member of a church is able to do that. Now, I know every member, idealistic. Just 10, 20, 30 or 50 or 100 people knowing what it means to follow Christ and equipped to be able to teach and model and reproduce that in others' lives. Now we're getting to the heart of reproducing the gospel to the nations. Share the word, show the word, teach the word, and serve the world. Here's the question I would ask us there. Are we discipling or disinfecting Christians? And here's what I mean by that. Disinfecting. Disinfecting isolates a Christian in a spiritual safety deposit box called the church building and teaches him or her to be good. That's what disinfecting is. Isolates a Christian in a spiritual safety deposit box called the church building and teaches him or her to be good. Now, holiness is defined by not doing wrong things. You avoid these things, you're holy. This is a sad point in the church because we become probably the only organization in the world that defines success based on what we don't do rather than on what we do. Holiness is avoiding these things. Be good. This creates a false hierarchy of goodness that we're all familiar with in a local church. The result is decent church members, decent citizens with little world impact, disobedience to God's command to reach the entire world, and ultimately a wasted life. Contrast that with discipling Christians. Discipling propels a Christian into the world to risk his or her life for the sake of others. Now success in the church is not defined by how many come in, but how many are going out. And holiness is not defined by what we avoid, but by what we're doing in the world around us. The result is disciples of Christ with total world impact, obedience to God's command to reach the entire world, and an abundant life. So how do we get there? I think the question we must constantly ask in the church is, how can we most effectively, in each of our contexts, how can we most effectively make disciples of all nations? You take those components together. Share the word, show the word, teach the word, and serve the world. And the reality is, where those come to an intersection in people's lives. This, for me, this is just on a personal note, these things intersect in the elders that I lead, small group of senior staff that I lead, and then a small group of men, 4 men, who are following after Christ. We're walking through this whole kind of picture together. And they know that the end goal is that they would be doing that in other guys' lives within a certain period of time. This is the picture. Where do those intersect? And we want to see small groups of disciple makers all across our faith family that are multiplying the gospel. All that leads to all nations. Everything we do in the local church, I'm convinced we must do ultimately for the sake of God's glory in all nations. In all nations. Now, there is a dangerous approach to the world that I believe is alive and well in our contemporary picture. You look on here and what you'll see is a variety of phrases that either folks in our churches would say when it comes to the Great Commission, or maybe even some of us in this room would say. First, but I'm not called to foreign missions. Anybody ever heard that? I want to ask if you said it. I'm not called to foreign missions. This is a radically unbiblical statement on a couple of different levels. When we say that, and people say that, normally mean one of two things. Either they mean we're not called to missions, and by missions we mean an optional program in the church reserved for the faithful few who are actually called to do that. And somehow we've taken, at this point, the command to make disciples of all nations and relegated it to a calling for a few people. And we hear Matthew 28:19, make disciples of all nations, and we think that means other people. We go to Matthew 11:28-30, though, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, I will give you rest, and we think that means me. Acts 1:8, you'll be witnesses to the ends of the earth. Well, that means other people. 1 Peter, cast your cares on Jesus, he cares for you. That means me. By what right have we drawn a line of distinction between the privileges and the obligations of Christianity, relegating the privileges of Christianity to all of us and the obligations to a few of us? This misses the whole point. This is a command. Make disciples of all nations. This is not a calling. This is not a matter of calling. Calling is how the command is fulfilled. I'm not saying that all of us in this room have the same calling in our lives. We've got different gifts and skills and passions and different areas. And the same certainly goes across the churches that we lead and we're a part of. But the reality is, whatever we're called to do is the means by which this command is played out. The danger is we substitute the two and we relegate this command to make disciples to some calling for a special few. This reflects an unbiblical understanding of our salvation. And I would point to the Bible for this one. But more specifically, I mean, you see the whole purpose of the people of God all throughout the Bible is to impact nations for the glory of God's name. You listen to Paul talk about the very purpose of his salvation. Galatians 1:15-16. God was pleased to reveal his son in me. Why did God reveal his son to you, Paul? So that I might preach him among the nations. That's why he says in Romans 1, I'm obligated, both the Greeks and non-Greeks. I've got a debt to pay to the nations with the gospel. Every saved person this side of heaven owes the gospel to every lost person this side of hell. That's the picture here. Why would we, with the gospel of Jesus Christ that has saving power for the nation, sit back and make excuses for why we're not going to take it to them? Doesn't make sense at all. Not if we're saved. This is one of the ways we get people to go overseas at Brook Hills. We tell them that they are not Christians if they don't. Don't take that to theology of salvation. I don't really mean that, literally. But if Christ is in you, then you want the world for Christ. This is the picture. Second statement. Wouldn't it be better for me to give than to go? Don't have time to dive into this in depth. But we say, well, wouldn't it be better for me to give money instead of going there? This reflects an unbiblical understanding of the gospel. I remind you at this point, when God decided to bring salvation to you and me, he did not send cash or check or money. He sent himself. Let us not be so foolish as to think that our money, although we need to be wise with our use of money, there's no question, that's a whole other discussion, but to think that our money is the answer to the needs of the world. We want to show the gospel, want to share the gospel, we go with the gospel. This is the way the gospel is advanced, not through checks, but through people. Now we need to use our money. Another story. Third, what about the needs here? Ever heard this one? What about the needs here? This is why do I need to go around the world? Don't you know you're going to fly over a lot of lost people to get there? This is a spiritual smokescreen. The reality is, most people don't care about the needs here either. How active are we? We're really involved in feeding the hungry in Louisville. How many people are we leading to Christ in Louisville? This is a spiritual smokescreen. And it's couched in such spiritual language. Well, my heart is for the United States. Please don't say that. It sounds spiritual. The reality is God's heart is for the world. And you say you have a heart for the United States. You just have admitted that you have 5% of God's heart. And you're actually proud of this. Well, my heart's for Louisville. Or my heart's for Birmingham. Well, that's less than 1% of God's heart. Yes, there are needs here. So we meet the needs here. But who told us we had to choose between the two? This reflects a radically unbiblical understanding of compassion. Compassion is not selective. Well, either I'm going to do this or that. I'm going to go both and. I'm going to live my life for the sake of the glory of God everywhere. And wherever I live, it's not a place of ministry. It's a base of ministry. And I'm going to do disciple. This is how disciple making in Birmingham or Louisville or whatever small town or in the middle of Africa impacts nations for the glory of Christ. This is what Jesus is talking about. Jesus didn't go to mega geographic areas. He wasn't flying on planes all around the world, but he was living his life there with 12 men for the sake of us gathered here in this room today celebrating the gospel. This is disciple making. The danger of separating these two, saying, well, either I'm going to serve there or here. The danger of separating local and global is, you think about it, draw on our own convention as an example here. 16 million Southern Baptists, 5,000 missionaries. Okay, if our strategy is either you go here or there, and 5,000 are going to go there, and the rest of the 16 million are going to stay here. What that means is locally, we're going to keep 99.97% of our people. And globally, we're going to send 0.03% of our people. So what we've devised then, if that's our strategy, and this is not in any way intended to be critical of IMB, this is just a picture of the mentality when we separate local and global. If that's our strategy, then we're going to put 0.03% of our people in 95% of the world. And it's going to equate to one missionary for every 1.25 million people. And each missionary out there can handle 1.25 million people, and we'll sit back in self-saturated America and figure out how this thing looks here. We can't separate these two. What if there's another alternative to that picture? What if there's another alternative that says we're going to produce world-impacting disciples in our churches? And this is just one practical way. This is where short-term missions comes in for us. Through short-term missions, and I realize there's a lot of abuses of short-term missions, and it needs to be done well, but through short-term missions, we encourage one another. What I challenge our people to do is to give 2% of our time each year, works out about 1 week, 2% of our time each year in context around the world in a way that radically transforms the other 98% of our time here in the process. So we challenge our people to give themselves other contexts, 2%, just a week out of their year. In a way that will transform disciple-making here and fuel disciple-making there. I'm not saying that we can make disciples in a week in another context, another country overseas, but we can. We can come alongside brothers and sisters around the world and join hands with them and go into the world together. We're joining hands with national disciple-makers and churches in other contexts and going into the world with them. World-impacting disciples in our local churches and then ever-multiplying churches. We're advancing the gospel with faith families around the world, and together we're impacting the world. World-impacting disciples, ever-multiplying churches. Let's give ourselves to that. All that leads to the win. And this is the picture. This is what I live for in the people God's entrusted me to lead. World-impacting disciple makers, I want to live for men and women who are multiplying the gospel by making disciples of all nations with their lives. Who in this faith family that I'm leading is multiplying the gospel? I want to live for them to multiply the gospel. We are a faith family, I pray, full of world-impacting disciples who really believe that our lives were created to impact the world, and we really believe that a church of world-impacting disciples can shake the nations for His glory. Okay. That probably best expresses my thoughts on how this command looks in the local church.